The boys are back. The boys are back in town.
I'm back, baby. Wait a second. Okay, wait a second. Maybe technically I'm not necessarily back. I mean, I've been doing these daily podcasts every day this year so far, but the majority of them have been by myself. And so I'm back recording a full length episode with fellow humans, and it feels so good. I cannot wait for you to check out this episode. Today is National Beer Day, and to celebrate, this is my conversation with Damian McCann. Let's get real technical here. He's the chief brewing officer at Summit Brewing in St. Paul, Minnesota. We talked about German beer culture and Belgian beer culture, American beer culture, Irish, Scottish, and which one is better. Foreshadow. One of them he considers a true art form. This was one of my all-time favorite conversations on the podcast, and this is why.
Where do you live?
In the city.
Do you have a house?
Apartment.
On a rent?
Rent.
What do you do for a living?
Lots of things.
Where's your office?
Don't have one.
How come?
It's a long story.
Do you have kids?
No, I don't.
How come?
What's your record for consecutive questions asked?
38.
Why do you wear 38?
You talking to me?
Who are you?
Pop quiz, hot shot.
You expect me to talk?
Have you ever listened or heard of the musical artist named Jacob Collier? He is a brilliant Grammy Award-winning virtuoso musician, super young, groundbreaking. Like, he won all these awards on his first. Listen, the guy's a freaking genius. I was recently listening to an interview with him. He was talking about the first time he got to have a conversation with Quincy Jones, the producer. And they had a long conversation. And he said instantly, even though he was nervous at first, he just felt like this sigh of relief when he was talking to him. Not because he was just nervous that he wouldn't like him. He, like, the nerves are like, well, I want this person to like me. I want to impress them. No, he said the foundation of it was that kind of conversation where you leave feeling seen. That's not, I don't want to say empathy, but solidarity maybe is a better word for it, where you're just like, oh man, I'm not the only one that looks at music like this. I mean, there's other people out here that think the same way as me. That is how I felt in this conversation with Damian. Okay, I'm just gonna be real with you for a second. In the modern American beer culture that I live in, I just feel like I'm on freaking crazy pills sometimes. And Sarah and I talk about this all the time. Like I just said earlier in the intro of this, I genuinely feel like beer is super important and I have a passion for it. I think beer is so connected with the history of humanity, and I think that is an important thing to be respected and honored still in the tradition, and even the tradition that's found in styles and how you can go to other countries and you can taste beer and you're tasting literally the geography of wherever you are and the history, and you're tasting the politics. We talk about this conversation, how politics impacts the beers that people are allowed to brew and the taxes that are put on beers. And so that changes the way things change. And it's fascinating to me endlessly. But sometimes here in the U.S., I feel like we just have, here's my problem. I think we've just bastardized beer culture. The fact that you will go into just about any brewery in the U.S. and they're going to be selling hard seltzer blows my freaking mind. I'm not going to get my soapbox about that right now. And this is, I'm not throwing shade at breweries for doing this because that is the market. But like this looking at beer as like an alcohol delivery system, and maybe we can just get away. How can we get as much of that flavor out and the carbs will be healthier and we can just go get straight to the delivery of alcohol into our system? It's infuriating to me. And the amount of breweries that just constantly seem to be popping up, thinking about money first. It's opened up as a business and we'll just figure out the beer later. Now, yes, beer is alcohol and we all have to figure out our own healthy relationship with that topic and that substance. But I just think overall, it just feels like the cultural conversation around it is less of an appreciation of it, less of thinking about the tasting and valuing this beverage, and more of a, are you a drinker or are you a non-drinker? Well, I'm trying not to drink during the week so I can drink during the weekend. Well, I'm drinking, I'm going hard, man. How many Bud Lights can I put down? Okay, I need to calm down. Take a deep breath, Morgan. Here's the deal. Long story short is that like the Jacob Collier describing this interaction, like, oh, I'm not the only one. That is exactly how I felt in this conversation with Damien. He is from Ireland originally, and he studied brewing and distilling, and he worked in Scotland and studied over there, and he worked for Guinness, and he ended up moving here to Minnesota, like straight over here into the States, right into middle America, to work at Summit because he believed that something special was happening at this brewery and that he could bring his expertise and passion to it and elevate it. They pioneered the craft beer movement in Minnesota. And I'm not just saying this because I'm introing a podcast episode. This podcast conversation came about because of my passion for this brewery. Long story short, this conversation came about because I was with Sarah and we were at a beer tasting that Summit had a table at, and I had a fascinating conversation with one of their representatives there. And because I posted that conversation online, I was reached out to by Julie Ebbetson from Summit, who is the marketing manager, and said, hey, would you be interested in having a conversation with Damien because he's fascinating and I think you would love talking with him? And I was like, hell yes, let's make this happen. So this episode is not sponsored in any way by Summit, other than the fact that I've drank enough of their beer that's probably in my DNA. So they're essentially sponsoring, like, let's like say the fingernails on my left hand are all probably at this point sponsored by Summit Brewing. But here's the deal. I'm the only reason I'm posting this podcast is because of you. If you are passionate about beer, if you're just curious about beer, no matter where you are on the spectrum of your beer journey, this is for you to have a conversation with friends. So pull up a stool at the Dubliner Bar in St. Paul and join us. We drink two beers on this podcast because that was our leaping off point. We recorded this a few days after St. Patrick's Day. And so we were going to drink a Guinness and then a Summit Oatmeal Stout. Both of these are the style of a stout. And so let's compare them and talk about what makes them different. I did not know that a Summit Oatmeal Stout is brewed in the tradition of a Scottish beer, which I thought was fascinating. So pull up a stool and have a conversation with two new friends who are passionate about the subject of beer. I'm going to just hit record.
Yeah, go ahead.
The worst thing is meeting someone. Well, cheers, but
Sláinte. You're good health. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day. Little delayed. Post, yeah. Happy recovered.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
That's a good point.
They're always pouring a great pint here.
Yeah, I think they go through a lot of Guinness here. I think, obviously, they're a big Summit account. We've always had at least a couple of handles on here at the Dub, but I think they go through. I bet Guinness is the number one selling beer. Guinness and maybe Summit Extra Pale Ale. So,
yeah.
As a result, you can taste it when they're cleaning their lines properly and they're really turning over the kegs and it's not sitting around.
Yeah,
you can notice the difference straight away. I've had a lot of good pints of Guinness in this town. And a couple of dodgy ones too.
Do you have another? Do you have like another pub that you think?
I think the local in Minneapolis is a nice
100%. Yeah,
those folks are really solid. So
my wife and I were back in Ireland in not this fall, but the last one, and I was talking to a couple pub owners, the big thing that surprised me was they were saying the number one thing is the flow. If you see a place that's dead that isn't serving anybody, that's
exactly right,
they're not going to pour.
Yeah, you've got to turn through the kegs that they say in Dublin. You've got to really move through the inventory because if it's sitting around, you know, even if you clean your lines well and you're doing a good job with the glassware and all of your pouring, your temperature's all correct, the beer is just sitting there.
Yeah,
that's an older keg. It's not going to be in great shape. So
being with Summit, you have all these accounts. How much of it is on your mind, like hoping that the beer is flowing?
It's a really important element of quality assurance and what we call the on-premise, right? Off-premise are liquor stores, and then the on-premise would be bars and restaurants. And, you know, my biggest concern is when the beer, the kegs in this case for draft beer, leave the brewery gate. I don't have as much control over the quality once they head out the road on the back of a lorry. So so I'm always worrying about, okay, how old is the beer? Has it been kept cold all the time down in the cooler of the pub?
Yeah.
Has it been served appropriately on the right gas mix? Are they cleaning their lines?
Yeah.
Are the Republicans cleaning the glassware with a proper type of detergent? Because I can taste crappy detergent inside of a pint glass. I can smell it on the beer. So all of these things are in the back of my mind. And absolutely, are they turning those kegs? Are they moving through inventory at a good clip? Or has that keg been sitting on for a month? Maybe it's the wrong size keg. That's the other thing. You know, maybe they ordered too many half barrels at once.
Yeah.
Should have gotten smaller volume kegs, like a sixth of a barrel, and then they can move through those kegs faster. So little things like that are really important from a product quality standpoint.
So if you had, say you had four of those that would match up to two of the bigger ones, would the beer then be, would that be almost better for somebody?
Yeah, it would be better because you're tapping a fresh keg a wee bit more often, right? So it's not sitting there and just hooked up all the way to the counter and the tap for a longer period of time.
If you,
and then you can also bring in maybe a couple of those smaller kegs every now and again as opposed to having a big chunk of inventory sitting in your cooler. So for some bars that are going to have lower volume flow through the pub, they should think about using a smaller size keg. And we sell a lot of 1/6 of a barrel kegs, almost as many as we do half barrels. Because a lot of places, they either have a small cooler or they just want to rotate through the kegs a little bit faster to manage the quality side of it. So we encourage them to say, hey, if you think you can't manage the quality by bringing in big half barrels, bring in a couple of smaller kegs. Don't worry. No one will think bad of you.
Totally. Oh, man, that is so funny.
It just what will work for the account and the quality of the beer.
You know? You're the only, it's the only industry, it seems like, where you're trying to undersell people. Like, no, let's not go too fast.
Maybe it's not.
Let's figure out how this relationship works.
I'd rather they bought a half barrel from a purely commercial perspective, but the quality has to come first, right? So that the customer needs to be assured of their purchase. When they're putting their hard-earned cash across the counter in that pub for their pint, they need to be able to buy in confidence.
Yeah.
They need to get a great pint every time. And my job as the brewer is to ensure the beer is in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
But I need the help of the publican, the retailer, to fulfill their part of the bargain, right?
Yeah.
So when they are serving that beer, are they doing a good job in terms of cleaning glasses and managing, you know, beer lines and all the rest of
it? Yeah. That is so interesting because the beer here is essentially you here. That's your
reflection of my brewery, of our brewery. Yeah. It's a reflection of me as a brewmaster.
Yeah.
And it's really important that from the consumer's perspective, they're getting that really good pint. Because they rely on someone.
Yeah.
They rely on our reputation for consistency. But I need the help of the pub owner. I need the help of the restaurateur to help me fulfill that part of the bar, to ensure that the consumer is getting a good pint every time. And it's the same. I used to work at Guinness. It was the same then. You know,
really?
So I had the same approach when I'd go into a pub. I want to be, you know, confident that the pub is looking after the quality of the beer and that the customer is getting a fair pint for a fair price, as the saying goes.
Oh, man.
The pint is the elixir. It lubricates the conversation, Rob. You know, but you have to have it in a great pub because you have to have the atmosphere that goes with a great pint. And then you bring it all together, and that's the crack, as we'd say back in Ireland. C-R-A-I-C. The good times, the good atmosphere, and the good chat.
Okay, it's funny you're saying that because I had a... So I just released on St. Patrick's Day when we were back over in Dublin. There's my friend, Dara. Dar.
Yeah.
Which means
Derek. So that's
Derek.
The Gaelic,
Gaelic
form of Derek. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Dara.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Dara and we sat down. He does a thing called, he's called the Guinness Guru for a while. So he reviewed all the pints throughout Ireland. And it was a blast. And we were talking about...
There's a lot of them.
It was crazy. And it was
fascinating. There's just one or two pubs over there. Rob.
Yeah, just one or two.
One or two, yeah.
But it's interesting to me, the realizing the mental difference between, I would say, even like Germany and Ireland are my two favorite gravitational pulls around beer. I feel like my three things that like Irish, mainly for Guinness, German beer, and Belgium.
Sure. The beer culture in Belgium is incredible. I mean, there's...
Yeah,
I would put it at the very, very top when it comes to, of any nation. Yeah, and I've been to Germany, I've been to the Czech Republic, I lived in the UK.
Yeah.
obviously yeah. from Ireland. Great
Czech Republic's
pubs.
Up there. Yeah,
Czech
yeah, that's true.
Great beer,
yeah.
But I think for pure beer culture, yeah. the Belgians are fantastic. They have specific glassware for each style,
oh, yeah.
for each brewery.
Yes.
They really get into
yeah.
it. And they're the folks that buy beer in Belgium yeah. are really well educated. They understand styles. They understand quality. And
when you say some of the people that buy beer, you mean like the general public?
Yeah, because they've been yeah. immersed in the yeah. culture for centuries. And they've been immersed in so many different styles in
yes.
that country, right? So the Irish are known for making stout, and the Germans make great Hefeweizen
yes.
and lager beers. The
yeah.
Czechs make great Pilsner.
Yeah.
But there's such a wide range and a broad variety
yes.
of styles in Belgium.
100%.
That they're incredible. But Germany is a lot of fun. But
yeah.
you go into a bar in Germany, it's very different than a pub in Dublin. You know, it's a
yeah.
it's a different atmosphere.
Yeah,
I love,
what do you
I
think is
both.
The biggest difference between...
If you go into a pub, everything's very organized.
Yes.
Very efficient.
Yeah.
In
yeah,
Ireland,
yeah.
it's probably just, it's a mad, it's just going to be an insane.
It might be half hardware
store.
Who knows? Yeah, yeah.
You could be, you know, yeah. The pub in my hometown, yeah. Mooney's in Monasterevin in Kildare, it's a fantastic place.
Yeah.
It's over 300 years old. You go in, you get yourself a pint of Guinness.
Yeah.
You can buy a pound of cooked ham and a loaf of bread, make yourself a sandwich because they don't offer food.
And you get, like, while you're there.
While you're there. You can get measured up for your coffin because it also serves as the undertaker
yes.
in the town.
Yes.
And you can buy a house because the publican also is a real estate agent. So
oh,
you can do all of
yes.
this at the same
everything
time.
Everything there.
You won't be doing that in Germany.
Oh, no way. Imagine, I mean, you're not going to be doing that here. You bring
no,
like
you're
an outside
not.
Sandwich
you're
and everybody looks weird at you. Nevertheless,
you want food?
There.
Here you go.
Yeah,
here's
yeah,
a loaf of bread.
Food.
Here's a pound of ham. Make
yourself. You make yourself, yeah. And it's cool.
It's
cool. I love that. Man, that's so true. Okay, where did you say you're from?
Monasterevin.
Monasterevin.
Yeah, in County Kildare, which is right in the Midlands of Ireland. So there was a brewery and distillery there for...
I never pull out my phone, but I have to look at this.
Yeah, there was a brewery and distillery there for over 150 years.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I got into brewing and distilling.
Really?
When I was in secondary school in Ireland, I did this research project on the local brewery and distillery. Cassidy's was the name of the brewery. And they closed
yeah.
during Prohibition. They, like a lot of Irish distilleries, they really struggled with Prohibition.
Yeah.
The Scotch whiskey fellas, the Scots were sharp, you see. They sent everything over to Canada because it was part of the empire.
Yeah.
And then the Canadians bootlegged it down into the States.
We're giving it to you.
The
you
Irish,
figure it out
the
yourself.
Irish
yeah, yeah.
By this stage, Ireland had left
yeah.
the empire, so they had
yeah.
no backdoor way of getting it
yeah.
you know, into the States. So
yeah.
a lot of them really struggled during Prohibition, and unfortunately Cassidy's closed. They were around for about 150 years. So I did a research project on the history of the distillery and brewery, and that...
While you're in secondary school.
While I'm in high school, yeah.
yeah.
And that led to me really getting an interest in the science and engineering
yeah.
behind brewing and distilling. I was already interested in science and engineering, so...
Yeah.
So I went on and did a master's degree in brewing and distilling and worked for Guinness for a couple of years. And
really?
And now you Yanks have been stuck with me, God bless you, for a couple of decades.
When did you move over? About 20 years?
20 years ago, yeah. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
okay.
moved up to Minneapolis in 2004 Ooh. From Nebraska, so just about around that
right.
time, it sounds like, probably
yeah,
then.
Yeah, yeah. It was right, yeah, a little bit before that, but yeah, yeah.
Was it straight into Minnesota from?
Yeah, I was recruited. I was working in
yeah.
London, at the
yeah.
London Brewery for Guinness.
Yeah.
And then my old professor called me up and says, "Hey, there's a brewery that wants to, you know, hire a classically educated European brewmaster."
Yes.
And I wanted to
oh,
experience
yeah.
the craft
yeah.
beer scene here in the States.
Yeah.
You know, I was really interested in coming across for a wee bit anyway. So
yeah.
I thought, of course, it'd be somewhere like Boston or
oh, yeah.
Chicago
yeah, totally.
Or, you know,
yeah.
Yeah, New York.
Yeah.
Or yeah.
Because
no,
when you
Minnesota.
Think about America, that could be Miami, that could be L.A., it could be warm.
No,
yeah,
it's Minnesota.
Right, yeah, Minnesota, yeah.
Yeah, and I've been freezing my arse off ever since over here.
So pull the wool over your eyes.
Oh, my God. But it's been great.
Yeah.
It's been great. I'm very fortunate. Summit's a great brewery.
Yeah.
It's a great community-based brewery.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fantastic people who work
yeah.
there. And it really has a set of values that resonates with my own beliefs in terms of the quality piece, respect
yeah.
for the customer, partnerships with suppliers, with the publicans, with
yeah.
the wholesalers,
yeah.
and really pushing that consistency angle. And I think that's the key. It's not taking any of that for granted and really continuing to build on the foundations that have been there for a long time. And Summit's a great brewery. It's not out of order.
Yeah, I love Summit. I think Summit is about as original in Minnesota as you can get. As far as breweries that are... All right, because here's the thing. When you're talking about... We talk about Belgian beer and how... You talk about German beer, you have different styles there. But Belgian beer is... You taste it And it's from a certain place. There's not only, there's like location culture, where it is, what abbey was brewed at.
What region of the country, whether it's more Flanders or maybe it's more the French-speaking area of Belgium. They have different traditions within each area.
Yes.
And I think what Summit has done well in terms of, you know, we're a legacy craft brewer. We're one of the older ones in the country now, coming up in 40 years old. And what I think...
40 years
old. That was 40, 1986. It's coming up fast. Don't think about it too much, you'll get depressed. But, you know,
no,
we're still young. We're okay, Rob. We're fine. We're fine. But, no, it really has cemented itself as the legacy craft brewer in this 100%. State and one of the, you know, the original craft brewers in the region, if not the country. And that's a position that the brewery has built on that foundation of quality and consistency and actually based around a lot of classical European beer styles. You know, we're going to talk about oatmeal stout here in a minute, which is a classic Scottish style of stout, but some of its best-selling beer is an English-style extra pale ale.
Yes.
We make a lot of good German-style beers,
all-time favorite
beers,
period.
So
in
the
US.
Beautiful German brew house. It's one of the few copper brew houses left for any size brewery in the United States. So there's a tradition at Summit that's firmly rooted in European, classical European brewing with a little bit of an American flair to it. And I think that's what's allowed Summit to do so well and continues to be so well respected across the United States and over in Europe.
Oh, okay, so you say 40, and okay, stick with me. I mean, I'm gonna try to think of how to make sense of this question, but like when you say 40-year-old brewery, that is a legacy brewery as far as the U.S. is concerned. I mean, I remember Michael Jackson, Beer Hunter,
coming
over to the States talking about stuff. It was like going to Anchor Beer, like when he was on the West Coast. It's like Anchor Beer was the legacy thing over there,
absolutely,
and now they're closed down.
Sierra Nevada, of course,
Sierra
would
Nevada,
be the big one in California.
Totally, yes.
Started 2 years before Summit, 2 or 3 years. You know,
so
Bell's Brewing up in
Bell's,
Michigan.
Yeah,
started
Which
around the
Bell's
same time.
Another one of my favorite.
Yeah.
I put Bell's and Summit as like sister in the
exactly.
In the
they started
there.
Around the same time.
Oh,
Larry
really? Okay.
Bell, who founded.
Yeah.
Bells and Mark Stutterud, who founded Summit, very, very good mates and have been literally since the 1980s when they started these breweries. And it's same with Ken Grossman over at Sierra. They're all the same generation. And back then, you know, we have thousands of craft breweries today, but back then there was only a handful of hooligans and reprobates that were deviants, as Mark would call them.
Yeah.
And it's they that group of individuals really helped to foster and develop
100%.
The craft brewing industry in the United States. And they all had a similar approach in terms of trying to make the best possible beer they could and provide choice and flavor and quality to the folks who, to that point, the only craft beer they could probably get was maybe Guinness, you know, or maybe a Bass if you're a rookie or a beer from
don't
Canada.
Don't even get me started how underrated I think Bass is
in
the States.
Yeah,
oh,
Bass,
and
yeah.
I feel like
we'll do another
like,
podcast completely on Bass. I've got a lot of Bass stories to tell you.
I'm totally in.
As a UK educated brewer, I've got a lot of stories about Bass.
Really?
So, fantastic. Great brewery.
Round two then on Bass, I'm way in.
The original English Pale Ale,
So,
but you're right. So Summit is 40 years old, but Guinness started in 1759. You know, so it's amazing when you think back at how young, relatively young, the craft brewing scene is in the States.
Oh, yeah.
Right? We think, it's been around for 40, 50 years. Even Anchor Brewing, when they came up in the late 60s and early 70s, it's not that long ago compared
totally.
To a brewery like Guinness, compared to some of the German breweries. Some of the Belgian brewers have been around since the Middle Ages. So it's...
I love that.
So it's all relative, right?
Yeah.
But they, you know, a brewery like Guinness has been pushing quality and pushing innovation and consistency since literally the mid-1700s, which is incredible when you think about what they've done for so long.
It is, I do.
We're standing or sitting here today drinking one of their pints.
That can be. I mean, you talk about the pinnacle of quality control, not even quality control, but like of the standard. We set the standard. And it better, when you get a pint of Guinness, especially if you're in Ireland, you better be tasting exactly what you pay for.
Exactly, and it's still the world's largest selling ale. People forget about that. You know, 100 years ago, Guinness was the largest brewery in the world. And it was all coming out of St. James's in Dublin, that one central brewery, huge brewery. And they have continued to really invest in the quality side of it. When I was at Guinness, we would spend millions of pounds a year just training bar owners and bar staff how to pour a proper pint, doing a two-part pour, waiting for the surge before you top off the pint, proper glass cleaning, proper gas pressures, all the rest of it. We would spend millions
just
doing
in
that.
Training.
Just training. Just for, on
not
pouring
even
pints.
On the beer itself.
Not on the beer itself.
How to get it from
just
that.
To pour it properly out of a faucet into a pint glass.
I love that.
And is people it, still make a bags of it.
Oh, man. Have you on Instagram, I don't know if you're on Instagram much, but have you ever, Shit Guinness is I think what it's called. There's an account that's just like the worst Guinness pours. And man, I played a show in Uptown a few weeks ago and asked for Guinness. They said, well, we only have Guinness in a can because our tap's broken.
Sure, yeah.
Are you fine with that? I said, yeah, that's fine.
Right.
Takes it, pours it from a foot up. I swear, like, I've got airy bubbles coming out of it. I'm like,
You could have shaved with that foam on there. Yeah.
You totally could have shaved with that foam.
There's
it's
a pint
crazy.
Of foam to go with your yeah, 2 ounces of beer that you had left in the pint.
Yeah. Oh, wait, give it to me. Is it 119 or 119.5 seconds to pour Guinness? Where are we at with that?
I always remember going with a 16 millimeter head of foam. I know that.
Oh, yeah.
16 millimeters, yeah. Not 14, not 18.
The head.
The foam should be 16 millimeters on a pint of Guinness.
16, I'm writing it down. 16 millimeters. I love that. That is, I mean, you bet millions of dollars spent
you know,
on how to pour it.
If you're going to do it, you might as well do it right.
Man, that's so funny.
The quality assurance team at St. James's Gate, they are very good at what they do and have some very, very smart people who are working on a lot of projects. But I think the basics to a beer like Guinness have remained the same for a long time. And that's really high quality malting barley, good hops, a very unique yeast strain, and one thing about Guinness that people don't realize, it's relatively low in alcohol.
Yes.
There's not a lot of booze in there. It's only about 4%, 4.1%.
Yes.
You know, in its draft form. Now, they do make stronger versions for bottled form and for the export market. But it's fairly light in calories. It's fairly light in body.
Yeah.
One of the challenges that we
that's
continue
a crazy
to
thing. All my friends are like, it's such a hit.
It's
brand
like drinking
thing.
Engine
no, it's
oil.
Or, no way.
And it's the same with our oatmeal stout. You know, we still have challenges. And our oatmeal stout's only about 5% ABV. And in many ways, it's a sweeter beer than Guinness is. Guinness is a little bit more hop forward and it's a lot drier.
Yeah.
But people still, you know, you drink with your eyes. So you see this stuff in a glass, you're like, oh, it's dark and black, and it must be, it's like drinking malt oil. It's the opposite. There are less calories in a pint of Guinness than there is in a pint of Budweiser.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yes.
So people, you know, one of the challenges we have is people have this preconceived idea of what the beer is before they ever try the beer, whether it's Guinness or Summit with our oatmeal stout. Like, I can't drink that. And then they have it like, this is great. It's fantastic. I'm like, Well, just try it.
Yeah, just give it a shot. I mean, it's not even black. We were talking, like, the whole thing, first thing I learned when we were over there the first time was like,
it's actually red.
It's actually a really, really dark red.
Red,
red, yeah. the education of the local scene. I mean, because America's interesting because, especially now when craft beer is this huge, like, trendy thing, I always say, to me, the craft beer tap room in 2024, for the past like 5 or 6 years, is kind of how the coffee shop in America was in the 90s. Like when Friends was on the TV show, the coffee shop was the place you go, you hang out, and now the craft brewery tap room is kind of that. Like, it's more legitimized in the eyes. But America, I feel like people still forget, like, we went into Prohibition as a beer drinking country, and we came out as a whiskey drinking country. And like the re-education of okay, give me your thoughts on this. Because my deal, I feel like...
Well, Prohibition, one of the reasons behind Prohibition was to destroy the power of the big brewers. You know, the brewers had...
That's a positive thing.
Yeah,
I've never thought about the positive side of that. They
basically, you know, with the creation of the three-tier system, it did ensure that the brewers couldn't also own the retailers, right? So the tight house system, which is still common in the UK, which our friends at Bass had, they once had 6,000 pubs that they owned, which didn't really help with choice and availability and kept a lot of smaller brewers in their place. One of the things that happened was the bigger brewers did lose all of that tight house estate.
Yeah.
And it in many ways, it did allow for a bit more choice and a bit more independence. The problem was, in many ways, the wholesalers, which are the mid-tier, ended up with all of the all of the power because they could decide to bring in spirits, they could decide to bring in beer.
Whatever's going to benefit them most.
Exactly. So, and I love our wholesalers, they do a wonderful job. But it definitely, when you created that three-tier system, when they set it up so differently, it changed the dynamic of beer in the United States. And we lost so many breweries during Prohibition. Yeah. August Schell's, our friends down in New Ulm, third oldest brewery in the country, they were barely able to survive by making soda, near beer, whatever it took to just get through.
Yeah, get through it.
The period. And
the beer's version of the pandemic.
That's exactly right.
Lasting
about 13, 14 years.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And a lot of mobsters and a lot of cats.
Yeah, a lot of people. You're the first person that ever put anything in my mind that goes, there was a benefit. There was a small benefit to Prohibition.
There was some, there was also a very strong temperance movement.
That's so interesting. Yeah,
but there was some degree of positivity coming from Prohibition in terms of, but it in many ways it almost backfired because we lost so many brewers because it.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a right way of addressing this and a wrong way, and total Prohibition was almost certainly the wrong way.
Yes.
I think we can all look back.
Yeah.
100%. From a historical standpoint, and understand that. But there were elements there that needed to be addressed that the three-tier system has addressed to a certain degree. But today, I can't own, shares in someone and own, a pub.
Yeah.
That's against the three-tier system. And
literally why Kieran had to sell or swap over.
That's why our friend Kieran Foliar, divested himself of his interest in the Irish pubs and, when he got involved on the manufacturing side, the whiskey side of things. So there's a lot of both state and federal laws that are on the books that are as a direct result of Prohibition and then the laws to repeal Prohibition in 1933.
Yeah.
And Guinness, of course, never had to enjoy
that because
there was not never was Prohibition.
Same
in
with
the,
Belgium,
in the,
same with... Yeah.
They never went through that.
And I wonder, man, I wonder how much of that is. My frustration or bummed outness is more in like the culture of beer in the States is still recovering from that, I think, because now, my wife Sarah and I talk about this all the time, but I'm like, I want my relationship with beer to be that in a way that I can have a lifelong relationship and love of this to be a part of my life. And I tell friends like that, and they're like, they're weirded out, especially so many friends are like, well, I haven't drank in 2 months and we're doing dry gin. Yeah. It's like, no, I want to make sure I can have a lifelong relationship with this because it's a cultural, beautiful thing.
It's a social beverage. It brings people together.
Yeah.
You come together over a pint to talk about the rugby or to talk about the weather or to talk about the Vikings losing or winning or Kirk Cousins buggering off to, wherever he's. So it brings, whether you're on the deck and you're grilling a few steaks or you're down the pub watching the match, it brings people together. It's a social beverage. And nothing brings people together like beer.
Yeah.
I like whiskey. I'm a distiller. But it's not the same as beer. Wine is not the same as beer. Beer is a low alcohol, pretty low alcohol, fairly low in calorie, beverage of moderation. You can have a couple of pints and still function. You can still keep the conversation going. Have a couple of pints of whiskey and see what will happen to you. It's a very different situation.
Totally different thing.
It's a very different beast. And that's what makes beer so special. And I think we absolutely lost that in this country because of Prohibition. If you look at some of the great family or city breweries in Europe, if you go to the UK, there's still big family regional breweries that have been around for a couple of hundred years.
Yes.
Guinness has been around for over 250. You go to Belgium or Germany, and they have these local breweries that have been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
The reason they still have these big community-based breweries is because they never went through Prohibition, and they never had their society completely reorganized around alcohol the way that we had to do it here in the States with the 19th and 21st Amendments. It absolutely changed society. And I think you're spot on. I think the craft beer movement, in many ways, help to bring back some degree of beer culture, but it's still not the same because it doesn't have the historical basis, right? So our oldest craft breweries only go back to the 1960s, 1970s. So for someone from the UK or Belgium or Germany, to them it's just beer. It's a Cask Initian pale ale. It's a bottle of Duvel. Yes. It's a nice Hefeweizen. we have beer, macro beer, and then we have craft beer. Of course, yes. In America, we have to be different.
Yeah, you have to be
we are different is because of the impact of Prohibition and what it did to some of those older breweries, and then the mergers and acquisitions that then happened in the 50s and 60s with some regional players, whether it was Schmidt or Schlitz or Pabst, and they basically just got gobbled up by entities that just grew and grew, and now you're either huge like an Anheuser-Busch, or you're one of 9,000 smaller breweries.
Yeah, there's no in between.
No, not really. No. People think Summit's a big brewery. We're a tiny brewery. Compared to Guinness, we're...
Oh my word.
It'd spill totally, more in a day than I can brew in a year. So it's completely different perspective.
When I think about the numbers of Guinness, it's just like, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around that, those kind of numbers. It's bonkers. Yeah. That the level of output that they're doing.
Yeah, they talk in millions of barrels a year. And, you know, even a brewery like Summit that does, say, 100,000 barrels, it's minuscule compared to what those fellows have put out.
And that's my thing. With the cultural aspect side that you're saying, even chatting with some friends where it's like, the thought, I can't remember the situation I was in, but it was something where someone brought up, oh, you know, you go to lunch, let's go to lunch, and have a couple pints at lunch. Like, that's a really common thing. And I've had some friends like, every day? What? 2 pints at lunch? I'm like, what are you talking about? Because, like, there's, like, this thing of, like, drinking. And, like, even the point of drinking, it seems like, okay, like, when I was talking to Dara in Dublin, he's like, man, he turned on me, he's like, can you just tell me what's up with, like, American culture? Because he's like, it seems like when people are drinking over there, it's going, that means shots, it means, like, 10 beers, you're going crazy.
It's American. What else would you expect? It's going to be taken up to a whole new level.
100%.
Density.
I was doing this whole, so the whole thing on this started, everything's like, a lot of it, the imagery is, like, Guinness related, just because I love it. And I was doing these daily episodes, I was calling Daily Guinness. And it was every day, I drink a pint of Guinness every day and record a podcast every day, short. And, dude, I couldn't believe how many people are like, a beer every day? Are you doing all right? Are you going to check? Have you talked with your doctor? I'm like, talk with my doctor? Dude, there's a lady who's like 105 in the middle of Ireland who's had a Guinness a day for 65 years.
You weren't drinking one back home, one a day. Your doctor will be having a conversation with you. Be worried about your heart.
Yeah, because he owns one of the pubs.
He owns one of the pubs.
Totally.
No, there is that tradition of you know, I work for Guinness in the City of London at the London Brewery, and you'd find, you know, blokes in business suits who would be taking a break from, you know, their stockbroking job or whatever it was. They'd have 2 pints of whether it's, you know, Guinness or maybe another low ABV beer, and then head back to work. And I think that's one of the things here in the States is that we like to store it all up and then hit it hard on a Friday night.
I'm taking a break. I'm only drinking on the weekends.
That's right.
It's like,
You're actually better off having one or 2 a day and not 8 on a Friday night with a couple of shorts thrown in there too.
Yes.
So it's that's part, I think, of the culture.
The culture is totally right.
It's you know, it's beer is a fairly low ABV beverage.
Yeah.
You know, and it lends itself to moderation.
Mm.
And that's the thing. I always tell people, if you're going to have a few jars of anything, just have a couple of pints of something low ABV, like an oatmeal stout from somewhere, like a Guinness, and go easy on the spirits, because you know, I love whiskey.
Yeah, same.
But it you know, it's a very, very high alcohol beverage, and you have to treat it with respect, or it will kick the living Jesus out of you. To be honest.
Okay, you said you're talking about London and with Guinness. There's a couple questions that come to mind. One I haven't gotten to the bottom of. What is a pint of plain? Is a pint of plain?
Well, plain would have been plain porter.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because I heard some people like...
So in the 19th century, Guinness was still making huge volumes of porter, which is the original style that they came up with back in the 1700s.
Yeah.
And stout is just a stronger, stouter version of porter.
Yeah.
So, you know, that porter that they developed in the 1750s was essentially a blend of 3 different styles. It was then called entire, because it was all entirely mixed in one cask, then aged, and then served together.
Yeah.
But it came originally from 3 different brew streams.
Yeah.
And then it became very, very popular with with some of the porters in Covent Garden and in the City of London. People forget that Arthur Guinness, he opened his brewery in 1759 in Dublin, but
yeah.
he trained as a brewer in the UK. He worked for a London brewery before he ever opened up his brewery in Dublin. So he's also from Kildare.
Yeah.
Which is my home county, of course. So, yeah. That there's three great men that have come from Kildare. Ernest Shackleton, the explorer, Arthur Guinness, and then Damon McCann.
Oh, man, I love that.
But he trained at a great London brewery, because porter is a London style. It's not an Irish style.
Yeah.
And then he came back to Dublin, and he opened up his brewery in 1759. And then in the late 1800s, Guinness developed a stronger, stouter version. That's where stout comes from.
Yeah.
Stout just means strong.
Oh.
It's like mild means young,
and
stout means strong, historically, when you talk about this beer. So plain would have been just plain porter, around 5.5%. And then they came out with an extra stout porter, which became extra stout, which was then just stout.
Interesting.
So they just cut the words off of
it.
But that extra stout porter was around 8% ABV. You have to remember that two world wars really impacted alcohol levels of beer in the UK and Ireland, because the Brits, to help fund both world wars, especially the First World War, they jacked up the duty. In the UK, you pay excise tax on both the volume of beer you produce and the alcohol content. Here in the States, we just pay on volume.
Yeah.
It can be 10% or 2%. You're going to pay the same amount of excise tax in the United States.
Oh,
in Great Britain and Ireland, you will pay a certain amount per barrel, and then times the alcohol level in the beer. So you're going to pay a lot more for a 10% beer as a brewer in tax than a 2% beer. So Lloyd George, who was the Prime Minister during the First World War, was a teetotaler.
Yeah.
He believed that the greatest threat to the UK was not the Germans, it was alcohol.
It was alcohol,
So he taxed the absolute shite out of it.
Yeah.
And partly to help fund the war.
Really?
And then, the excise taxes came down during the interwar years, and the ABV went back up a wee bit. But then Churchill, who did like a pint and absolutely liked a dram of whiskey, he was forced to bring back up the taxation rate, which impacted ABVs again. Because the brewers just responded by saying, screw you, lads, we're just going to drop the ABV.
Because we got to keep the doors open.
So Guinness Extra Stout went from around 8% ABV in about 1912 to about 5% ABV in about 1946.
What?
Yeah, huge drop in alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but plain porter, to make a long answer even longer. Plain porter was just a standard, bog standard pint of porter that you'd find in a pub in the 1800s in Ireland, and eventually that beer formed the basis of stout. And by the 1950s, Guinness had basically stopped making porter. So when I was a lad, my grandfather would say, I'm going to go down and get a couple of pints of porter.
Yeah.
And I'd say, hold on, grandfather, they haven't brewed porter since 1956.
Yeah.
He's like, it all happens die hard.
Yeah, yeah.
But it would have been, draft stout. So,
man. Yeah, because I remember I was kind of researching it a little bit. I still couldn't figure it out. But they was talking about, the dying off of it. Because people would it was like an old-fashioned.
Yeah, and we make a great porter. It's called Great Northern Porter at Summit. Some of the American craft brewers were really instrumental in bringing back porter as a style, because Guinness had stopped brewing a porter. Samuel Smith's in Yorkshire in the UK had brewed porter. They had gotten out of all the London breweries had stopped making porter and switched over to pale ale.
Yeah.
And by the 1970s, it was hard to find porter almost anywhere. And then the American craft brewers, Anchor Porter from San Francisco, Sierra Nevada, Summit, Bell's, they really helped to bring back that style. And Great Northern Porter was Summit's second beer, released in 1987 after Extra Pale Ale in 1986. So that beer really helped to put Summit on the map and helped to bring back that style overall. But now Guinness has reissued some of their porter recipes and brought back some porter, which is good. It's a fantastic style.
Yeah.
But completely dominated by stout.
Totally. Yeah. Again, it's so interesting. Like, a whole culture of drinking changes because of legislation or things outside of some making those decisions.
Excise
taxes.
World wars.
Crazy to me. Crazy. Okay, do we want to? I want to be respectful of your time, but should we grab a pint of Summit?
It's got a pint of oatmeal stout. Yeah. They are ported here, right, Julie?
Yep.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah. This is what I was curious about. So, Summit is about 40, right? And I'm thinking about the conversations. I'm 38. And I'm thinking about the conversations I've been having with my 38, 40, almost 40-year-old musician friends. And a lot of them are badass players who paved the way musically. They came in part of the change of the sound, which is making me think about beers and brewing, like the change of people drinking more porters,
right,
whatever.
Right.
They're paid, and when I think about Summit, I just, the phrase that comes to mind all the time is like paving the way. Really, craft beer, especially in Minnesota, would not be the same without it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very true.
But so the problem, a lot of the conversations now reaching middle age as a musician are this balance between of who you are, like this is what I do, this is my sound, this is what I like, and things are changing around you. So this middle-aged musician is a tricky thing to balance between the what I do and what's requested of me, because that's what people know of me, and what I could do or want to do. That balance between essentially what I would compare to a brewery is like doing something different versus the consistency of what people have come to expect of you. Is that a conversation that exists within Summit at all
right
now?
It does, and it's a tricky balancing act.
Yeah.
Because I can't release 5-6 dozen new beers a year, right?
100%.
And I don't want to.
Yeah.
B, it doesn't make any sense for a brewery like Summit to do that.
Because all these younger breweries are doing that, and it's just like, well, I can't come here and get the same thing I loved. Because you're just changing and trying to, like, it's almost a desperation to sometimes.
Yeah, and Guinness can't do it either. They're not releasing dozens of new beers a year.
Yeah.
And
that's fair.
So
yeah,
it is a balancing act between offering something. Thanks, Les.
Thank you.
Offering something new and different.
Yeah.
And also adhering and maintaining the Sláinte, by the way. The values and qualities that have gotten the brewery to that place, you know, in the first place. And what at Summit, what we try to do is, rather than a shotgun approach where you're trying to release numerous new beers all the time, which is not sustainable, we try to really dig into what works for the brewery in terms of stylistic guidelines, and also what is going on in the marketplace, what people are asking for, what people are interested in.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of balance, I think it allows us to play around with maybe some new ingredients, some new styles, to explore some new approaches to different beers.
Yeah.
But also it allows us to maintain our footprint and maintain that kind of that safe harbor, if you will, for people when it comes to quality and consistency.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I love about Summit is that we have good distribution. Right? You can go to a lot of pubs all over the state of Minnesota, and you can find Summit Extra Pale Ale. You might not be able to find a whole lot of, you know, other beers with more character, shall we say, in some of these places.
Yeah.
But that, to me, is the safe harbor. That's the quality option that... I know Summit EPA really well. It's a high-quality beer. It's been around. It's tried. Yeah. It's trusted.
Yeah.
It's made by people who care.
Yeah.
And I can find it in, you know, northern Minnesota in a small pub in the middle of nowhere. I can find it on the border with Iowa.
Yeah.
And that's really important for us, because that visibility is important, but that choice of quality for the consumer is important. So if they don't want to drink Bud Miller Coors, and they want something with a wee bit more character, they can find some extra pale ale. But also,
you're so polite, and I understand
Irish
you can't.
Irish diplomacy.
Yeah,
after a few pints.
It's so, this man might have like the total shit beer that is again. But it's like totally
rather underwhelming in terms of its flavor profile.
Yeah, 100%. But again, as someone who's, I played all over Minnesota the 20 years I've been here, and I've, like, the corners of it, you're totally right. Like, I can go into a tiny local bar and find some EPA on tap and know, okay, I can get a good pint here.
Exactly, a good pint, a fair pint at a fair price. And we like to come out with new beers. We like to play around with new and experimental ingredients.
Yeah.
The key is to not overly focus on the bright, new, shiny object, you know? To make sure that you're still keeping your eye on the ball when it comes to quality for your oatmeal stout, for your Great Northern Porter, for your extra pale ale.
Yeah.
And then the part of the balance is, and then also working on developing maybe a couple of new beers and executing at a high level.
Yes.
So taking care of the due diligence in advance, whether it's, you know, vetting ingredients or doing some small scale batches.
Yeah.
And then working with, you know, the folks at the retail level, the wholesale level. And
man,
there's a lot that goes into it. You know, when Guinness produce a brand new beer, they have a couple of advantages over someone like Summit. One, they've obviously got the resources. Yeah, they've got a few quid back there they can spend.
They can tell it.
But they can also go back in time and dig through the recipe books from 1780 or 1825 or 1910 or 1942, and they can literally drag something out that there might not be anyone alive that's ever even heard of this beer before.
Yeah.
So when you have that historical basis to dig into, that gives them, in many ways, a huge library that they can go back into. Guinness made pale ale once. They made Dublin ale once. Most people never even heard of any of these beers.
Yeah.
But they did make them, and they're in that vault, essentially, that they can go into and pull from. If we're a craft brewer, maybe we'll come at it from a different perspective. Maybe we'll make a style that is either underrepresented in the marketplace or something that we think is a good fit for the brewery. Or we've got great relationships with our maltsters and our hop suppliers.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some fun new hops that we want to take a look at for a project. So, the key is, Rob, is you too many folks will just throw a shite at the wall and pray it sticks. It's not innovation. It's gambling. And one thing that I will never allow is for our brewery to make our customers pay for our learning curve or make them pay for our mistakes. That should never happen. So when that beer hits the trade, it should be a pretty solid, well-rounded beer that's gone through a certain process to get there in the first place.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
that's the approach to quality and consistency that's really kept the brewery moving forward and allowed us to build up that reputation. And we have to do whatever we need to enhance and ensure that reputation is maintained long term.
Because, I mean, I won't say names, but out of learning your diplomacy. But, I mean, I've seen a few breweries, microbreweries in the cities come out that I was really pumped about. And unfortunately, kind of maybe same things, they were sending out beers that people were getting, and it was like off beers, and like, well, we're so small, we have to sell these, and then it just snowballs,
and some of those folks are in a tough spot because they are relying on selling those beers, right? They might not be in a position where they can dump the tank and start again. There's so much money invested, and I understand that. The challenge there, though, is they won't be able to really build up a reputation for quality and consistency, and You should never be afraid to dump a tank of beer if it's not hitting your marks, right? If you're not hitting the specifications or the sensory's not right. You try to do everything in your power to avoid that happening in the first place.
Yeah.
But a good brewery, whether it's a Guinness or a Summit, if it comes to it, that beer will get the boot. And you always learn from that too, right? Again, you know, the brewer is learning, okay, maybe we had an issue somewhere along the line with an ingredient or process. We'll figure that out, and we'll ensure it doesn't happen in the future. But we're not letting the consumer, letting Rob down at Dubliner Pub pay for that mistake. That's part of the philosophical approach to making beer that that really is important to me and our founder Mark Stutrud. That goes back to those legacy craft brewers all those years ago when they got into the game, and it's been the case in classical European brewing for centuries.
Man, everything you're saying is like totally in my mind going in and then filtering and thinking about how it's all the same with music. It's like, I think the biggest, like when thinking about how, in the conversations I've been a part of, think about the future and staying true to like staying hip, I guess is the word I'm thinking of. Staying like cool and relevant maybe is another word I think of. It's easy to start thinking in binary terms. Well, that means I got to change my sound. I got to be like this. It's almost like a binary, well, I can be myself or I can be relevant. And when you're saying this, it's like, well, it doesn't have to be that way. You can experiment in these ways and still be yourself and find out what works within your voice of brewing or music or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, Mozart's still hip.
Yeah.
Robert Johnson is still hip. Led Zeppelin are still hip. So, there's a timeless element
to
music, but there's also a really timeless element to a beer like Guinness. It's been around for hundreds of years. There's a timeless element to a brewery like Summit.
Yeah.
And it goes back to that philosophical approach that underlines what those breweries do and how they approach making beer. And We have to try and remember that. We can't lose sight of that as a brewery, but as an industry.
Yeah.
You know, as craft brewers, as legacy craft brewers, we have to remember that and always have that in the back of our mind when we're approaching, whether it's new beers to come out with or looking after existing beers.
Yes.
And having that conversation with, you know, the folks down at the Dubliner to make sure they're moving the kegs through at a good flow, you know, that they're cleaning their glassware. So it's all linked together.
Yes.
That's what we have to understand, Rob.
You saying that makes me think like, oh, that's right. Okay, I want to be, I want to refocus myself and continue like I want to be a legacy craft bass player, like thinking long term of something that has that of lasting value. Because I read years ago in Steve Martin, the comedian's, his autobiography. You talked about how he gets asked all the time, like, what's your advice for being a comedian or, like, making it in show business? And he's like, nobody likes my advice because they want advice about how to be famous or get an agent, all this stuff. He's like, get good. And this thing was like, get so good they can't ignore you. And I feel like, and rightfully so, like, I also don't want to, like, I don't want to bullshit here and act like life doesn't happen. Like money, the times, things can get hard. So just keeping your door open sometimes, I think, as a brewery, as a musician, is winning.
Sure.
That's winning. But there's also another level where it's, like, get good. Can you make a great, for me, can you make a good Pilsner? If you're, like, you know.
Toughest style of them all to make.
Toughest style to make. It's so
toughest
hard.
Toughest style
it
of
really
them all.
Is. But can you make that?
The beer of truth. Nowhere to hide.
It is really the beer of truth. Yeah, I love that. I have a buddy, a friend of mine, she used to own a brewery in the cities, and she's like, Pilsner, she's like a porter or stout or something else. She said it's like a muumuu dress, like a big wavy dress I can wear. She's like, but me making a Pilsner is like wearing a bikini. There's nothing. It's all out in the open.
You can hide a double.
It wasn't my saying. I didn't say it.
You can hide a double decker bus inside of a pint of double IPA. There's nowhere to hide inside of a pint of Pilsner.
Oh, I love that.
It's the same. It's the same as her now.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh man.
But I think, but having an evolutionary approach, I think is fine. You don't have to try and reinvent jazz. You're not trying to reinvent bass playing. You're not trying to reinvent making stout. I think there's a lot of challenges, and I think there's a lot of grace, and I think there's a lot of satisfaction to be derived from consistent improvement and incremental change and making progress.
Yeah,
you know, Arthur Guinness was a revolutionary brewer in many ways, but his brewery has been evolutionary in terms of how it's moved forward through the centuries. In this case, and you know,
it's
there's nothing wrong with that. They've done a heck of a job in terms of product quality, and I think Summit will continue to evolve into the modern era. In the next 40 years. And the next 40 years will be different than the previous 40 years, and that's fine. Things change, things evolve. But I think that's what people also need to remember, that you don't have to try and be uber-revolutionary all the time. And American craft brewers sometimes will fall into that trap where they're constantly trying to either reinvent themselves or throw shit at the wall and praying that some of it sticks. And there's no need to take that approach. I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think it's good for those breweries. I love the creativity, and I think one of the things that attracted me to brewing in the first place was that creative outlet that it presents.
Yeah.
But we can also take it just a wee bit too far. And then we start causing problems with product quality. Then we start alienating consumers. Then people start saying, whoa, this beer is bloody different every time I have it. I can't trust it. I thought I knew the beer. I'm going to go drink something else. Give me a craft cocktail. That's a challenge that the industry needs to think about. And we need to continue to push all of beer forward and to be as inclusive as we absolutely can. Because you're right. We went from being a beer country, essentially, to being one that's, you know, a bit more spirits dominated. But beer is still the great social beverage.
I mean, even in spirits, like spirits start as beer.
Yeah,
it's exactly. Like the foundation
exactly right.
of that.
Every distillery in the world has a brewery.
Yeah.
Every single one.
Yes.
Every single brewery, every single distillery has a brewer.
Yeah.
So you have to start with.
Yes. Oh man, I know I'm sounding so cheesy right now, but it totally is with like music tie-ins where it's like, yeah, the fundamentals. If you're starting with a shit beer, your whiskey is gonna be shit. You have to get those down and then pull in the things that serve you. At least where I'm at right now.
And there's a lot of structure.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to creating a great beer.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's structure.
Yeah.
The ingredients have to be integrated appropriately
yeah.
in the recipe. You start yeah. with that. Malt is the soul.
Yeah.
You know, hops are the spice. Water is the essence and yeast is the magic. You have to bring all four together appropriately. They
yeah.
have to be integrated appropriately to create a really well-balanced, flavorsome, complex drink. And that takes time. It's not easy to do that.
Yeah.
And you really need to understand the fundamentals that
yeah.
go into all of those elements.
It's,
I'm not a musician, but I've got a lot of friends. I really appreciate music. I've got a lot of friends who really appreciate jazz,
yeah,
which I like along with blues. And we've talked about this a lot in terms of the structure of jazz, the structure of blues, the structure of beer, and how there's an overlap there. And it's really interesting to think about that.
I have a ton of friends. Jazz was never something I never go, I need to turn on. My wife Sarah does, and I enjoy it, but I'm never like, oh, this is the soundtrack of my evening I need to listen to. But it is really it's almost the language or alphabet of music that other things come out of whether you recognize it or not, and it's making me think, same thing with the beer. Like,
yeah.
That's the fundamentals, the alphabet, the language of making something good.
Exactly. And, you know, when we're making an oatmeal stout, I think about, okay, well, there's some stylistic guidelines
yes.
there, right?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a Scottish style stout. It should be a wee bit more fuller body than an Irish stout like Guinness. It shouldn't be quite as hop forward as, say, an Irish stout. It should have a really smooth body to it because the oats will provide that smoothness, that depth, that
yeah.
creaminess.
Yeah.
While in a beer like Guinness, it's just straight, you know, roasted barley and pale malt. So when I'm thinking about the flavor profile, I have some stylistic guidelines to adhere to. I have some guardrails
yeah.
that tell me, okay, you know, don't banjax this by adding too much in the way of hops or making it too dry.
Yeah.
It's not meant to be an Irish stout. It's
yeah.
a Scottish-style oatmeal stout.
Yeah.
And that provides me with the direction. And then as a brewer, I can maybe, okay, I'll use this hop rather than that hop, or I'll
yeah.
bring in this type of, you know, chocolate malt rather than that type of chocolate malt. I can put my own flair, my
yes.
own spin on things, but there's a foundational element that as a classically educated brewer, I should adhere to. That provides me with a solid basis to work from. And I think if you're a bass player,
yeah.
I'm guessing you can throw in all sorts of flair and you can put your own interpretation,
yeah.
but there is a base to all of that,
yeah.
an element that you can build off of.
Yeah, and if there's no, like, the older I'm getting, the more I'm realizing, like, the boundaries that used to be like, oh, these boundaries, whatever. The boundaries are where the creativity comes in. It's like, oh, this is the language we're all talking right now. And it's got to fit within here. So figure out what, like, so we're talking the same language here. And then another tune will be a different style.
And that's what I love about beer, because
yes.
if it's an English-style
yeah.
pale ale, I've got a pretty good idea of what the flavor profile
yes.
should be like.
Dude,
if it's a
yeah.
Czech pils,
yes.
fairly sure I know what's going to be in that
yes.
pint glass before I ever try that style.
Yes.
Ever try that beer. Now, I appreciate the brewer putting
yep.
his or her interpretation and maybe, you know, playing around with some stuff,
yeah.
but the basis to it should be the same. It's been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Because that's my biggest pet peeve is, like, this, we have a new, okay, Oktoberfest is blowing up right now. Beers seem to be huge over the past 5 years growing. Everybody's doing their version. It's like, well, I taste an Oktoberfest, and someone's like, what do you think of this? It's like, well, are you asking if I think it's a good beer, or are you asking if I think this is an actual Oktoberfest beer? Or, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, this is great. I would totally drink this.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call this an Oktoberfest. Would it, you know, so those language things, and people like this. I know. I don't like to think of myself as a snob, but it's like that's the fun for me, where it's like you can make whatever you want, but you can't. The language, like where you're putting it, yeah. what you're calling yeah. it, is important.
Don't jack up the hops in your Oktoberfest. Yeah. It's
not, I know.
It's not meant to be a hoppy lager. No,
but a hoppy Oktoberfest hoppy will get me just like.
But it's the same with an Irish stout.
Yes.
Irish stout should be dry.
Yes.
It should be bitter. It yeah. should have a pronounced hop character, yeah. as our pint of Guinness had. Oatmeal stout should be more fuller bodied.
Yeah.
Should have a real smoothness to the complexity yeah. from those oats. It should be lower in terms of hop character.
Yeah.
Because in Scotland, they don't grow hops. It's too bloody cold. The weather's yeah. awful up there. They grow yes. barley and they grow oats.
Yes.
So they would brew with the yeah. local ingredients.
And that's the culture thing. I love it. It's like you drink something and you go to another country and you should be drinking the culture. And by drinking it, you should be thinking, it should tell you the agriculture there, the history of the politics there, and it tells you so much.
Quality of the water.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to a place like yeah. Burton-on-Trent in the UK, yeah. which is where India Pale Ale came from,
yeah.
the water there is really hard. It's high in sulfate. That allows the hop character to really pop in your beer. It allows you to make really good, clean, hoppy beers. Now, you go to Dublin, and it's there's more chloride in the water, which gives more mouthfeel to those stouts.
Yeah.
If you go to Pilsen, or Milwaukee, or St. Paul, the water is very soft, which yeah. would allow you to make really nice lager beers,
yeah.
like a Pilsner. So one of the reasons that the classical German brewers, like Miller and Coors and Anheuser, when they came to the States, they put these breweries in areas where the water quality mimicked what they would have seen in their home countries. So St. Louis has yes. soft water. Milwaukee has soft water. St. Paul has soft water. All these German brewers knew they needed soft water to make their lager beers.
Yeah.
You notice that Bass didn't put a brewery in St. Paul because the water's too soft.
Totally.
Throw all that gypsum in there to toughen up the water. But you cannot make really high quality pale ale
yeah.
with a soft water supply. You're going to yes. have to change it. You're going to have to Burtonize it.
Really?
Which is what breweries started doing. So London is the same. So London and Dublin have similar water profiles. That's why, you know, porter is really a London style of yeah. beer, and pale ale is from Burton-on-Trent
yeah.
up in Derbyshire. So,
okay, here's the deal. I'm just say it right now. Every fiber of me right now does not want to put an end to this, but it's only out of the trying to be respectfully.
We got a few more minutes.
If you're ever interested to do like a bass hang, or
just,
and then just see where that goes to.
Yeah.
This is so fun. I feel like. I owe you for the MasterCast.
World's first registered trademark.
Yes.
The Bass Red Triangle.
Oh, don't even give me a start. Okay. I'm not going to ask any questions on that. I'm going to save them for round two. I feel like a jackass asking you about a beer that's not Summit, because you're going to probably, but I've been really curious about this thing, and I'm just now realizing you're the person to ask. So let's end it on this. Guinness opened up a brewery on the East Coast.
Yes, in Baltimore. Yes.
So I'm nervous. Yeah. Did they really close? No, they closed it.
It's closed.
So are they not reopening?
They closed the Baltimore brewery. They're
like,
not
done. Done.
Yeah, they're done. They're not reopening.
I was gonna ask. Like,
so Guinness.
I was curious about that.
Guinness have always had a strange relationship with opening breweries outside of their homeland, outside of Dublin.
Yeah.
The first brewery they opened outside of Dublin was in London in the 1930s.
Okay.
And the reason they really opened it was because at the time, Ireland and Great Britain were in this economic war where the Brits would tax all the agricultural products coming out of Ireland, you know, butter, milk, all the rest of it. And the Irish were taxing the living bejesus out of steel and coal coming from the UK. Guinness said, screw both you guys.
Yeah.
I'm going to open up my own brewery in London. That way, the Brits will not be able to tax Irish beer coming out of Dublin. We're going to get round the tax dodge. We're going to brew in London. So they opened this brewery, and they had that brewery for till about 20 years ago. Then they closed it. Now everything's come out of Dublin. But they've also brewed under contract all over the world.
Yeah.
So they'll brew in Singapore. They'll brew in Nigeria. They'll brew in Kenya. They'll brew in Australia.
Yeah.
So they've tried to open breweries in the U.S. every now and again. They opened one in the 1950s. on the East Coast. It went nowhere. It was a disaster.
Because
all
the
expats, all these Brits and Paddies who like their Guinness from Dublin still wanted it from Dublin.
Yeah.
So the Guinness we had this afternoon.
But I mean, I know it's been a long podcast episode.
It's just after St. Patrick's Day, so
I'm
not even sure what day it is
totally
anymore.
I'm totally flipped.
So, so the Guinness we had today, you know, those kegs come from St. James's Gate in Dublin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think people here in the States, they want what they believe is the real deal. So Guinness has always struggled with opening breweries outside of Ireland and struggled with the market. Now, they've done some taproom stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they have a taproom going in Chicago. I think they're keeping the taproom in Baltimore. But people, when they part of Guinness's connection with people in general, with beer consumers, is the history, the quality, the legacy that is St. James's Gate.
Yeah.
And if I was going to brew Summit down in Texas, that's great, but Summit's a Minnesota brewery.
Yeah.
We have a strong connection to the folks here.
Yeah.
People, I think they really like to support our brewery for many reasons, but we are a Minnesota brewer. And I think with Guinness, people want to drink Guinness in part because they know it's made at a 260-year-old brewery in Dublin. And I think that's part
you're tasting history.
It's part of the base elements of the beer that connects to people. And I think that's when they opened that brewery in Baltimore. It's a beautiful brewery, by the way, and they put a lot of money into it. They did it right. They always do. But it's hard to form that connection. I want my pint of Guinness coming from St. James's Gate.
Yeah.
And I think people were like, oh, this is great. They're making some nice beers. But it's not the same.
Oh, I would be, you know how pissed I would be if I if I got cans of Summit and I poured my glass at home and I look at it and it's like brewed in Texas?
Yeah, you're not. It's
like,
not the same.
Screw this.
It's not the same.
Yeah, not the same at all.
Not the same at all. And you know, we distribute just in the upper Midwest.
Yeah.
We are firmly embedded in this regional footprint.
Yeah.
And I will have folks that or coming back from Arizona or coming back from, you know, overwintering down in Florida. And they know they can't get Summit down there, and they love to stock up when they're here and bring cases back with them.
Yeah, you bring
them.
The family,
It's a part of the connection that they have with the beer and the brewery. And I think it's something similar with Guinness, just on a different scale. And breweries have to remember that. They have to think about that. You know, we're all in this desperate rush to broaden distribution as much as we can, but do you lose the connection with folks?
Yeah.
Or do you struggle to resonate, you know, when you're away from home? Coors is a famous example.
Yeah.
Once upon a time you could only get Coors on the west coast of the United States. It's a Colorado brewery. They took it national and it never quite had the same connection.
Yeah.
It's done really well, obviously. But a different type of connection to folks.
Yeah.
And breweries have to think about that, because we should be community-based. We should be involved in our communities. The community of the Twin Cities and Minnesota in general helped build Summit Brewing.
Yeah.
And we're incredibly grateful for that, and we want to maintain that connection to that community. And I think there are Guinness fans, because they maybe have been to the brewery, they've been to Dublin.
Yeah.
They feel that connection.
Yeah.
And it's important. And Guinness has learned a lot from that Baltimore experiment, shall we say.
I believe it. Oh, man.
There's your Irish diplomacy
there
out
is,
there.
There it is, yeah. Totally. Thank you for hanging out with me.
Yeah, it's been great.
This has been amazing.
Yeah.
I hope for whenever we're working schedule, do it a round two or something.
Let's do round two. Let's talk about pale ale.
I'm all in.
We'll talk about extra pale ale.
Fun,
we'll talk about Bass. And I've got a few more yarns for you, so we'll kick those over a few jars. And
thank you for hanging out. I'm going to end it here.
You've been listening to Rob Morgan is a Curious Person. Nothing you've heard in today's episode reflects the opinions or beliefs of Guinness, Curious Endeavours, the Republic of Ireland, or anyone living or dead. Quite frankly, those who said it have probably already changed their minds, and we offer you the most sincere apologies on their behalf. Rob Morgan is an internationally touring bassist on a journey to discover what it means to live a curious life. At thecuriouspod.com, you'll find an archive of conversations recorded all over the world, a map of recording locations, a weekly newsletter, and official podcast merchandise. Rob is recording a daily podcast where he's sharing insights into the creative journey and the secrets to living a curious life that he's discovered from over a decade of traveling the world with music. We here at Curious Endeavors have told him this is probably a mistake and he's an idiot to attempt it, but he won't budge, so that's where we're currently at. Visit thecuriouspod.com today or click the link in the show notes for more great crack. We hope you'll enjoy.
Meow.